Based on the recent statement of North Korea, I have decided to terminate the planned summit in Singapore on June 12th.
The art of no deal, with North Korea at least. It's Friday, May 25th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Doug Bernardi in Washington, sitting in for Jim Stevenson. Happy Friday. Join us on VOA Asia Facebook. President Trump stuns Asia by suddenly canceling the U.S.-North Korean summit in Singapore. Or did he just postpone it? We'll explore. Also ahead, Malaysia's returning prime minister confronts a financial mess. Thai entrepreneurs profit from the most unlikely of creatures. And keeping cyclists safe among the cars. It's all ahead on today's VOA Asia. Well, today was supposed to be the day that the world media focused on North Korea's controlled demolition, allegedly, of its nuclear testing facilities. More on that in a moment. But the news was rapidly eclipsed by U.S. President Donald Trump's surprise announcement that he was canceling the much-anticipated June summit in Singapore between himself and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. So surprising, in fact, that not even South Korean officials had any heads up on the announcement. Mr. Trump made his wishes known in a letter to Kim, here read in its entirety before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo.
Dear Mr. Chairman, we greatly appreciate your time, patience, and effort with respect to our recent negotiations and discussions relative to a summit long sought by both parties, which was scheduled to take place on June 12th in Singapore. We are informed that the meeting was requested by North Korea, but that to us is totally irrelevant. I was very much looking forward to being there with you. Sadly, based on the tremendous anger and open hostility displayed in your most recent statement, I feel it is inappropriate at this time to have this long-planned meeting. Therefore, please let this letter serve to represent that the Singapore summit, for the good of both parties, but to the detriment of the world, will not take place. You talk about your nuclear capabilities, but ours are so massive and powerful that I pray to God they will never have to be used. I felt that a wonderful dialogue was building up between you and me, and ultimately is only that dialogue that matters. Someday, I look very much forward to meeting you. In the meantime, I want to thank you for the release of the hostages who are now home with their families. That was a beautiful gesture and was very much appreciated. If you change your mind having to do with this important summit, please do not hesitate to call me or write. The world, and North Korea in particular, has lost a great opportunity for lasting peace and great prosperity and wealth. This missed opportunity is a truly sad moment in history. Sincerely yours, Donald J. Trump, President of the United States of America.
Shortly afterwards, Mr. Trump, speaking from the White House, blamed the summit's cancellation on recent official North Korean statements critical of Vice President Mike Pence and indirectly on influence from Chinese President Xi Jinping. And yet, while announcing that the summit was off, Mr. Trump suggested it could still happen at some point.
A lot of things can happen, including the fact that perhaps, and would wait, it's possible that the existing summit could take place or a summit at some later date. Nobody should be anxious. We have to get it right.
From the outset, the U.S.-North Korean summit presented more questions than answers. What was its ultimate purpose? Why was it happening so fast? And how would it be judged? Still, news of the summit's postponement is being welcomed in some quarters. Evans Revere is senior director with the Albright Stonebridge Group and has participated in numerous dialogues with both North and South Korea. He told VOA Asia's Ira Melman via Skype that Trump's cancellation may actually be good news.
Well, I must say, to be very frank with you, I was relieved, especially that it is happening now rather than to have it happen at the summit, and the it being the recognition by the president and his administration that the North Koreans are not serious, or at least not serious at this point, about denuclearization.
Do you think there was a turning point here? Why do you think that this happened now? Is it the given idea about the harsh rhetoric over the past week or so?
I read the president's letter carefully, and I would hope that the United States government and the president in particular are not reacting to a letter or to a pair of messages, rather, from two senior foreign ministry officials, the first vice minister for foreign affairs and then just a few hours ago, the vice minister, both of whom I know quite well. I hope they didn't react to their statements as being statements from the lips or from the pen of Kim Jong-un, because they are not necessarily that. They're authoritative, they're official, but they don't necessarily reflect all of the thinking of the North Korean leadership. So there may have been something else communicated by the North Koreans in recent days through the channels that have been established that made it pretty clear that the North Koreans were either having cold feet or were prepared to come to the negotiating table and say and do things that were not acceptable to the United States.
What do you think it was?
It's hard to say, but I note with great interest that just a few hours ago, as I was waking up early this morning, I saw an interview carried on the CNN website with an unnamed senior administration official. And I have to paraphrase it. I don't have his exact or her exact words in front of me right now. But that senior U.S. administration official made it very clear that there was no agreement on the part of the North Korean leader to denuclearize, that Secretary Pompeo in his two visits and others in their visits and in the ongoing communications between Washington and Pyongyang had not received a firm commitment by the North Korean leader to denuclearize. The way that this official put it is that we are waiting to see if the North Korean leader will make a commitment to denuclearize. We are going to try to maintain our contacts and continue to stay in touch at high levels. And this was, by the way, before the president's letter was released and his decision was released. But the import of this statement was that the U.S. government to this date has not received a firm commitment from North Korea to denuclearize.
Evans Revere with the Albright Stonebridge Group. Oh, by the way, the big story that got buried by all this today, North Korean officials invited Western media to witness what it called was the shutting down of its nuclear test site to demonstrate its commitment to denuclearization. North Korea conducted all six of its nuclear tests at the underground site that includes at least two extensive tunnel systems. We invite you to read more on this, our top story, by following us on Facebook, VOA Asia, and on our website, voanews.com. These are among the top Asia stories currently trending on voanews.com. China and Japan criticize Washington's latest moves on an auto tariff. Malaysia's returning prime minister says his country is facing financial destruction. An Islamist mob destroys a minority worship site in Pakistan. The U.S. is considering a new top military commander for Afghanistan. Expanded coverage of these stories and more at our website, voanews.com. VOA Asia continues. Malaysia's Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad, back in power after a 15-year hiatus, says his first 20 years in office were, quote, fairly easy compared to what is confronting him now. Massive debt in a country with an international reputation for corruption. Mahathir returned to power on May 9 in a spectacular election upset that saw him unite with his former opposition foes to overthrow a prime minister, Najib Razak, who is accused of helping to steal billions from his country in one of the biggest corporate frauds in history. Najib denies all the charges. In an interview with VOA, Mahathir said despite his reputation, he remains committed to a free and fair Malaysia.
My reputation was actually created by those who were against me, particularly those in the opposition. Normally, the opposition's way of dealing with the government is to demonize the government. And, of course, the government also does the same thing to the opposition. Now, I was labeled a dictator, for example, that I was very strict and I was imposing my will on the whole country, which is a picture created by the opposition. But in reality, I was not that kind of authoritarian ruler. No authoritarian ruler has ever resigned. I resigned because I felt that the people would not be so much against me, because the majority of the people here do not accept the caricature of me created especially by foreign press. So when you say that I used to practice all these things, it's not quite true. If you examine my record, I was a very open leader, and I consulted all my colleagues whenever I do anything. And during my time, when there was a challenge against me from within the party, I allowed due process to follow, and I very nearly lost. Nowadays, with this government, if you go against him, say a few words against him, you get sacked from the party. Now, who is a bigger dictator? And about the detention of people without trial, this was done by the first prime minister, the second, the third. And when I became prime minister, I released 21 people, political detainees. But I don't have political detainees, excepting when they do something that threatens the security of the country. Then they are detained, but only for a short while. I wanted to abolish the law which allowed me to detain people without trial. But of course, enforcers, police and all that, they would like to retain this with this law, because it makes it easy for them to ensure that security is maintained. But frankly, I didn't like this law, and now I am quite happy that I'm in the opposition. And the strange thing is that this man who's been demonized by the opposition is now accepted by the opposition as their leader, actually asking me to lead them. The opposition, who used to say nasty things about me, if I'm really that nasty, they wouldn't want me to be leading them.
Newly installed Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad on his return to office. You're listening to VOA Asia. Happening now in Asia, HSBC Holdings is continuing a hiring spree for its equities business in the Asia-Pacific region. HSBC has hired Deutsche Bank's Isabella Kwok as a managing director for Asia equity sales with a China focus. Others joining the London-based bank in Hong Kong include Edmund Wong from Citigroup and Vivek Gandhi. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. And we're happy you are with us on VOA Asia today. Controversial oil exploration along a wild stretch of Australia's southern coast, fabled for its whales and surf, has sparked protests outside a resources conference in the city of Adelaide. A Norwegian company plans to start drilling in the Great Australian Bight next year. We hear more now from Phil Mercer in Sydney.
The Great Australian Bight is a large open bay off the coast of southern Australia. It's home to sea lions and sharks and is a nursery for the endangered southern right whale. It's not only an ecological gem, but an economic one. Resources companies have long nurtured ambitions to drill for oil and gas in the area. Conservationists believe that development of the Bight has the potential to cause environmental devastation that could have consequences to other distant parts of the vast Australian coast. Activists have staged a mock oil spill in protest outside a meeting of industry representatives in Adelaide. Nathaniel Pelle, a spokesperson for Greenpeace, says there's mounting community opposition to the plan.
People of the Great Australian Bight, fishermen, mayors, tourism leaders, Indigenous leaders, have not consented to this company drilling in this area. Nobody here wants to risk an oil spill.
The mayor of Kangaroo Island in South Australia, Peter Clements, was so worried about the prospect of oil exploration in the Great Australian Bight, he travelled to Norway to tell the annual general meeting of the country's biggest oil and gas company, Statoil, what his community thought of the plan. Resources giants BP and Chevron each have recently abandoned plans to drill in the area because of concerns over the low price of oil and other strategic reasons. But Matthew Doman, a spokesperson for the Australian Petroleum Production and Exploration Association, says the Norwegian plan will proceed responsibly.
Quite clearly, there are some in the community who are opposed to this endeavour. We understand their environmental concerns, but we're very proud of our track record of protecting the environment while we develop the economy, create opportunities and jobs, and we're determined that we'll do that in South Australia as we've done in other areas.
The Australian government has previously said that future oil and gas development in the Great Australian Bight would strengthen the nation's long-term energy security. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And you're listening to VOA Asia.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This news alert from VOA Asia. A night train has collided with a truck in Vietnam, killing two people and injuring nine others. The collision occurred at a crossing in the northern province of Tha Hoa early Thursday morning. Vietnam Railway Corporation say seven cars derailed, some of them rolled over. Two train drivers died. For all the latest, stay tuned to VOA Asia. In Thailand, the giant African snail, once condemned as a slimy pest that ruins crops, is now being bred for the same reason that some people found them so unappealing in the first place, their slime. Experts say the slime produced by these giant snails is full of collagen and other ingredients that can regenerate skin cells for use in the cosmetics industry. VOA's Mariama Diallo has the story.
By nurturing these snails in this kind of environment, snail farmers say they also get something in return.
If we keep them happy by providing them with a pleasant habitat and good food, they'll be healthy. The mucus they produce will also benefit us by generating more profits.
The Thai farmer tends to about 3,000 medium to large-sized snails, which he says can bring him nearly $950 a month. Keeping these snails happy also has other advantages, says this snail expert.
They'll eat a lot, just as they do in the wild, and produce a large amount of mucus. Keeping them in a natural and organic habitat also prevents animal cruelty.
Traditionally, snail farmers agitate their snails to force them to produce the valuable slime. But in this farm, they use water to stimulate the animal to produce the gel-like secretion, which in turn is sold to Aden International, a food and skincare company based in Thailand.
We turn part of the freshly extracted snail mucus into a face serum product.
The rest of the product is processed into powder and sold to other cosmetic companies. Snails use mucus to protect their bodies against cuts and bacteria. The substance contains elastin, proteins, glycolic acid, and an antimicrobial that's said to work wonders on one's skin.
We export the mucus powder to Korea and the United States as a cosmetics ingredient.
There are about 85 snail breeding houses in this Thai province of Nakhon Nayak, about a two-hour drive from Bangkok. To keep them healthy, it's reported these snails typically get a four-month break so they feel happy and well-rested after having their treasured assets extracted. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
The latest news alert from VOA Asia, Islamic fundamentalists in Pakistan have demolished a century-old place of worship belonging to the country's long-persecuted minority Ahmadi community. An Ahmadi spokesman denounced Wednesday night's attack in the eastern city of Sialkot, saying that a mob of over 600 men from the Sunni Muslim community took part in the destruction of the century-old compound. All these stories coming your way throughout the day on VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, a 102-year-old woman from New York who set a world record as a runner only 7 years ago has published a memoir documenting the achievements and tribulations of her challenging life. Ida Keeling's newly published book is titled Can't Nothing Bring Me Down. VOA's Zlatica Hoke has more.
Ida Keeling began running in her late 60s. At the age of 95, she set the world record for her age group in the 60-meter race. She's also the first woman in history to complete a 100-meter run at the age of 100. Keeling's latest achievement is the book titled Can't Nothing Bring Me Down. What could have brought her down was the death of her two sons within a year from each other.
Well, after they passed away, I just couldn't get over both of them. So I just couldn't. I felt like I was going down. I'm already short. I'm getting shorter. I'm getting meaner. And I don't want to talk to nobody. Something went wrong, and I blamed myself.
Keeling says she took up running at her daughter's suggestion.
I went with this run, but while I was running, I was feeling my strength, and I was feeling like I was coming up out of a hole, and I just kept on going.
Despite arthritis in her fingers and knees, the 102-year-old starts every morning with stretching and some exercise, including push-ups. She encourages other people to stay physically active, regardless of age.
Get up and get around. Don't sit around doing nothing. Get up and do something. Sometimes you got things that, well, I don't like to do this. Get up and do it and get rid of it and look. See how different you feel. It's a big thing.
The number of people who live to be 100 is relatively small, but growing. The 2010 census recorded 53,000 centenarians living in the United States, 20,000 more than in 1980. Scientists say good genes are important, but that a healthy lifestyle and exercise contribute to longevity. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
Finally today, drivers can choose from several GPS apps that alert them to accidents, but bike riders, well, they're on their own, except not many more, as VOA's Faith Lapidus explains.
It's called Flare, and it looks like an ordinary light you clip onto your handlebars. But Jake Thompson, a product design student at the University of Sussex, says the three buttons on its surface let cyclists report problems they encounter on roads the moment they see them.
Any of the data points that you can press are poor road surface, which covers potholes and broken road surfaces, and even glass on the roads, which you can specify after you drop the data point. The second one is road danger. So if you experience a close pass or a near miss, and you feel a danger on the road, after you have experienced that, you can press that button to highlight that. And the last one is the junction danger. So hard to navigate or busy junction that's poorly designed, that you want to flag up as a place for potential redesign.
Each click of a button sends the location of that problem to a phone app. After their ride, cyclists confirm their flares on the app and add comments. Their reports can be loaded onto a map. Thompson says that data can show local governments where to target funds for road repairs to give everyone a smoother ride. Thompson has been contacted by local authorities in California and Australia about setting up pilot schemes there for what he calls the first app-integrated smart bicycle light. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
And thanks so much for joining us for VOA Asia. You can get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud and take it with you, or find us at voanews.com. I'm Doug Bernard in Washington. Have a great weekend.